swear, Sereyad, son of my mother and of Morad, to remember the wrong done forever, forever. They were still, the bitter faces and the shrewd, the hard-worked hands and bodies. They sat still in the warm, rainy southern dusk and heard that song like the cry of the gray swan of the cold seas of Ea, yearning, bereft. For a while after the song was over, they kept still. "That's a queer music," said one, uncertainly. Another, reassured as to the absolute centrality of the Isle of Lorbenary in all time and space, said, "Foreign music's always queer and gloomy." "Give us some of yours," said Sparrowhawk. "I'd like to hear a cheery stave myself. The lad will always sing of old dead heroes." "I'll do that," said the last speaker, and hemmed a bit, and started out to sing about a lusty, trusty barrel of wine, and a hey-ho, and about we go. But nobody joined him in the chorus, and he went flat on the hey-ho. "There's no more proper singing," he said angrily. "It's the young people's fault. Always chopping and changing the way things are done, and not learning the old songs." "It's not that," said the skinny man. "There's no more proper anything. Nothing goes right anymore." "Aye, aye, aye," wheezed the oldest one. "The luck's run out. That's what. The luck's run out." After that, there was not much to say. The villagers departed by twos and threes until Sparrowhawk was left alone outside the window and Arryn inside it. And then Sparrowhawk laughed at last. But it was not a merry laugh. The innkeeper's shy wife came and spread out beds for them on the floor and went away, and they lay down to sleep. But the high rafters of the room were an abode of bats. In and out the unglazed window the bats flew all night long, chittering very high. Only at dawn did they all return and settle, each composing itself in a little, neat, gray package, hanging from a rafter upside down. Perhaps it was the restlessness of the bats that made Arryn sleep uneasy. It was many nights now since he had slept ashore. His body was not used to the immobility of earth, and insisted to him, as he fell asleep, that he was rocking, rocking. And then the world would fall out from underneath him, and he would wake with a great start. When at last he got to sleep, he dreamt he was chained in the hold of the slaver's ship. There were others chained with him, but they were all dead. He woke from this dream more than once, struggling to get free of it, but falling to sleep at once re-entered it. At last it seemed to him that he was all alone on the ship, but still chained, so that he could not move. Then a curious, slow voice spoke in his ear. "Loose your bonds," it said. "Loose your bonds." He tried to move then, and moved. He stood up. He was on some vast, dim moor under a heavy sky. There was horror in the earth, and in the thick air an enormity of horror. This place was fear itself. And he was in it, and there were no paths. He must find the way, but there were no paths, and he was tiny, like a child, like an ant. And the place was huge, endless. He tried to walk, stumbled, woke. The fear was inside him now that he was awake, and he was not inside it. Yet it was no less huge and endless. He felt choked by the black darkness of the room, and looked for stars in the dim square that was the window. But though the rain had ceased, there were no stars. He lay awake and was afraid, and the bats flew in and out on noiseless leather wings. Sometimes he heard their thin voices at the very limit of his hearing. The morning came bright, and they were early up. Sparrowhawk inquired earnestly for Emilstone. Though none of the townsfolk knew what Emilstone was, They all had theories about it and quarreled over them. And he listened, though he listened for news of something other than Emmelstone. At last he and Arryn took a way that the mayor suggested to them, toward the quarries where the blue dye earth was dug. But on the way, Sparrowhawk turned aside. "This will be the house," he said. "They said that that family of dyers and discredited magicians lives on this road." "Is it any use to talk to them?" said Arryn, remembering Hare all too well. "There is a center to this bad luck," said the mage harshly. "There is a place where the luck runs out. I need a guide to that place." And he went on, and Arryn must follow. The house stood apart among its own orchards, a fine building of stone, but it and all its acreage had gone long uncared for. Cocoons of ungathered silkworms hung discolored among the ragged branches, and the ground beneath was thick with a papery litter of dead grubs and moths. All about the house, under the close-set trees, there hung an odor of decay, and as they came to it, Arryn suddenly remembered the horror that had been on him in the night. Before they reached the door, it was flung open. Out charged a gray-haired woman, glaring with reddened eyes and shouting, "Out! Curse you, thieves, slanderers, lackwits, liars, and misbegotten fools! Get out! Out! Go! Ye'll chance be on you forever!" Sparrowhawk stopped, looking somewhat amazed, and quickly raised his hand in a curious gesture. He said one word, "Avert!" At that, the woman stopped yelling. She stared at him.
"Why did you do that?"
"To turn your curse aside." She stared a while longer and said at last, hoarsely,
"Foreigners?"
"From the north." She came forward. At first, Arryn had been inclined to laugh at her, an old woman screeching on her doorstep, but close to her he felt only shame. She was